In Charleston that September, a heat wave put a stranglehold on the city. The sun seemed parboiled as it made its slow transit across the peninsula. Because of our nearness to the Atlantic, the humidity seemed man-killing and inescapable as I made my torpid way from class to class. It had pleased me immensely when I found myself in the same classes as the twins, the orphans, Ike Jefferson, Chad Rutledge, and Molly Huggy. And yes, I recognized my mother's handiwork in the arrangement and understood that she had drafted me as her watchdog over a group that still seemed flammable to her. Of course, Sheba Poe, with her incandescent, voluptuous beauty, was a natural enemy to my mother's intellectual sensibilities, and Trevor seemed like a creature imported from an undiscovered planet. Starla carried her woundedness like a weather report issued by her damaged, wandering eye. Niles played his role of guardian angel to his sister, but to my mother he seemed unanchored, a young man turned inward because of too many responsibilities given him at too young an age. "That boy never had a childhood," my mother announced at dinner one night. "Niles is a fine young man," Father said simply. "Too bad his sister's a head case," my mother said. "She's a nice girl, Mother," I protested. "Why don't you cut her some slack?" "I don't like the way she looks at me," my mother explained. "That's because one of her eyes is looking due west while the other is looking straight ahead. That's not her fault." "I'm talking attitude, not strabismus or whatever malady she has." "Dr. Caldwell has agreed to operate on that eye," I said. "I bet that changes everything about Starla. The eye makes her self-conscious." "How on earth will she pay for it?" Mother asked. "He's doing it for free." "Did you tell Dr. Caldwell about Starla?" my father asked. "Yes, sir. I told him this summer, one night when I was collecting from him for the newspaper. He's already examined her, and he'll operate when he has an opening." "So your nice boy set this up, Lindsay," my father said with pride. "That girl's personality is set in stone," Mother said. "She's a head case. Moving her eyeball isn't going to change a thing. Mark my words." By the end of October, my football team was still undefeated. But Coach Jefferson made us well aware that we had been luckier than we had been good. He swore we could be in better shape, and he made us out-hustle every team we played that season. I would feel half dead after one of his practices. Fate has its own quirks and defiances and accords, as I was to learn one night after I got home from such a grueling practice. When I walked into the house, my father said, "Your dinner's in the refrigerator, son, and that pretty Molly Huggy called." "Molly?" I asked. "Why'd she call?" "Don't know," Father said. "It wasn't me she wanted to talk to." I picked up the phone in my bedroom. Then I found myself almost faint with fear. I realized I had never called a girl. My distress came not from being unnerved, but from feeling unmanned. My hands trembled and felt clammy. It became clear to me why I was suffering from this unexpected panic attack. The reason I had never called a girl was that I had never dated one. Even to me, that seemed like an odd and illogical fact in the life of an 18-year-old boy. Molly and I had developed an easygoing friendship in the first month of school, and we sat next to each other in three of our classes. So I summoned up a small reserve of courage and dialed Molly's number. Her mother answered on the first ring. When I gave my name, her voice turned frostbitten and brittle. "Molly isn't here, Leo. Good night," Mrs. Huggy said, then hung up the phone. I was rising out of my chair when the phone rang immediately. I answered it as my parents had taught me to do. "King Residence, this is Leo speaking." I heard Molly laughing at the other end of the phone. "Do you always answer the phone like that?" "No," I said. "Sometimes I say, 'This is Leo King, and you can kiss my ass, whoever you are.'" "Of course, I always answer like that. You know my mother now. This house has 10,000 rules." Then fiery words broke out between Molly and her mother. Because Molly's hand covered the receiver, I could not make out the words, but there was genuine fury in the muffled exchange. Finally, Molly said,
"Mama, I think I deserve a little privacy. Thank you very much. Leo, are you still there?"
"Still here," I said. "Anything wrong?"
"Yeah, there's a lot wrong," Molly said.
"Chad and I had a fight, and he broke up with me today. In fact, just a few minutes ago."
"What an idiot," I said. "Is he nuts?"
"What makes you say that?"
"Because you're you," I said, flustered. "You're everything in the world."
"I was hoping you'd say something like that," Molly said. "That was one of the reasons I called."
"What was the other?"
"To ask if you could take me to the dance after the game Friday night."
I blushed so deeply and suddenly that I thought my face might have a crimson hue for the rest of my life. I hunted for words, but muteness had turned my tongue to stone. I prayed for an electrical storm to bring down the phone lines of the city. In wordless shame, I awaited Molly's intercession.
"Leo, are you still there?"
"I'm here," I said, grateful that my voice had returned to the stage.
"Well, what's the answer?" she asked. "Will you take me to the dance or not?"
"Molly, you're Chad's girlfriend. I know how much he thinks about you. I know how proud you make him."
"Is that why he asked Bettina Trask to the dance?" she said.
"Is that why he asked that big-titted tramp to the sock hop?"
"Bettina Trask?" I gasped, stunned at the news. "Does Chad have a death wish? She's Wormy Ledbetter's girlfriend. That's like committing suicide."
"I hope Wormy beats the snot out of him."
"We can plan Chad's funeral if you like. I know how this story's going to end."
"I don't want to talk about Chad. Will you take me to the dance or not?"
"Molly, I've never been on a date. I wouldn't know what to do or say or how to act," I said, each word coming out as slowly as an extracted tooth.
"I can teach you all that stuff," she said.
"Then I should ask you to the dance, shouldn't I?"
"That's the normal procedure," she said.
"Molly Huggy, would you go to the dance with me Friday night after the game?"
"I would be most honored, Leo," Molly said. "I can't thank you enough for the invitation."
"Can I ask you a personal question?"
"Ask away."
"Have you ever dated another boy besides Chad?"
"Never."
She burst into tears and hung up the phone. In a reverie composed of both terror and ecstasy, I moved out toward the kitchen, where I began to warm up the meal my father had cooked for me. When I sat down to eat dinner, Father joined me, as he did every night, to discuss the events of the day.
"Did the chef do a good job, son?"
"He can work in my kitchen anytime," I replied.
"The flank steak's delicious. The squash and asparagus couldn't be better. The mashed potatoes, perfect. Balance is the key to everything. What did Miss Molly want from our boy?"
"The strangest thing in the world," I said. "She wants me to go to the dance with her after the game."
"Strange is not the appropriate word," Father said. "How about fabulous or splendiferous or prodigious? It's not a bad thing when one of the prettiest, nicest girls in the world wants to go dancing with you."
"Molly's way too pretty for a boy like me," I said. "Chad broke up with her today, so she's feeling hurt. Chad asked Bettina Trask to the dance."
"Uh-oh," my father said. "We know what that boy's after. Bettina has quite a reputation.
I've gotten to know her a little bit this year. Her family's poor, and her father's a no account. In fact, I heard he was in prison. But Bettina's really smart and, I think, ambitious."
"Wormy Ledbetter doesn't get you very far on the ambition scale," Father said.
"But dating Chad Rutledge will improve her social standing in a heartbeat," I said.
Father laughed and dropped his hands. "I bet Chad's stuffy mother goes nuts when she hears the news."
"Molly's mother didn't like it a bit that I called.
She couldn't even pretend to be nice.
South abroad is a conspiracy of platelets, son. Blood and breeding are all that matter there.
No, that's not true. There's got to be a truck full of money somewhere near the blood bank.
No wonder Molly's mother is upset. We don't have money. My God, we're Catholic. Not much family to talk of. Zip for aristocracy. Zip for clubs. From Chad Rutledge to Leo King. Molly's in a free fall.
I bet this is the first original thing that Molly's ever done, Father answered.
In a way, it's her Declaration of Independence.
What'll I do if Molly wants to dance?
Well, then you dance with her.
Dancing with a pretty girl makes it fun to be alive.
I don't know how to dance, not really. Sheba tried to teach me at my party this summer, but that's it.
My father slapped his hand against his forehead.
Damnation! We used to dance all over this house, with you on my feet and Steve on your mother's feet.
That's it, Leo. That's the cause. We stopped dancing after Steve died. We let our house die around us. The music died. We lost sight of you completely. We came close to losing you.
Jesus, you've never been on a date. What in the hell were we thinking?
None of us did well with the Steve thing, I said.
Tomorrow night, when you get home from football practice, put on your dancing shoes, son. This joint's going to be hopping.
And my father was as good as his word. After practice the following afternoon, I was driving Niles back to the orphanage when he surprised me by saying,
"Your father invited Starla, Betty, and me over for dinner. He said something about dance lessons."
"Holy God, Father gets so carried away," I said.
"You're lucky to have him," Niles said. "I wish he was my father."
"Do you know who your father is, Niles?"
"Yeah," Niles said. "Enough said."
"Enough said," I agreed. I could hear loud music pouring out of my house when I pulled up in the driveway, and I noticed that my mother's car was gone. My father was in the backyard grilling cheeseburgers and corn on the cob, and Betty was serving everyone coleslaw and potato salad from huge wooden bowls. Sheba and Trevor were throwing their trash into an aluminum can when Niles and I walked into the backyard.
Sheba said, "Hurry up, slowpokes. We've got to teach you boys some foot flogging. The party's inside."
Trevor was dragging Starla and Betty into the house. Father shut down the grill, removed his apron and showy toque, and hurried in to play his role of disc jockey. He was grinning with pleasure he could not contain.
"Where's Mother?" I asked.
"She wanted no part of this," he said. "She was mad as hell that I set it up on a school night, so she got huffy and went down to the library." Inside, Sheba and Trevor gave lessons in the basics of rock and roll, the shag, the fish, and even the stroll. The twins danced with the naturalness of trees moving with the wind. As they held each other, all the congruence and elaborateness of dance became clear to all us voyeurs who watched those bodies at play in their own divine gracefulness. But we were not there to observe, but to learn to dance. Trevor took the boys to one side of the room and began teaching us steps of great simplicity.
"Don't be afraid to make a mistake. You learn by making mistakes. You get better by making mistakes. Let yourselves go. Don't think. Just dance. Just let your bodies go. Dancing is just the body loving itself."
For 3 hours, we practiced steps and jumped around in a comedy of clumsiness and error. But because of the patience and goodwill of the twins, we ended up performing a rote imitation of the spirit of the dance. I started to loosen up and enjoy myself, and that night I was set free from my danceless body forever. Then they taught us the waltz, the pure finesse of the slow dance where you hold a girl's hand and put another hand on her waist and pull her close to you.
"The slow dance is really what all teenage boys and girls want to do," Sheba said. "You get to hold someone you adore and hold them close. Your cheek touches their cheek. You can breathe into their ear. You can let them know how you feel by how you touch or cling to them. You can tell each other's secrets without saying a single word. When a bride and groom get married, they always begin that marriage with a slow dance. There's a reason for that." Leo, let's show them that reason.
Sheba lifted her hand toward me, and I took it as though I were handling a stick of dynamite. My father put on a record called Love is Blue, an instrumental as pretty as a Charleston street. Putting my arm around Sheba's waist, I pulled her to me, and we began to dance. Not think, but dance. And Sheba made it look as though I could. I wanted that song to play on forever. But the record stopped, and time stopped, and Sheba and I stepped back from each other. She curtsied, and I bowed. I felt blooming and handsome and untoad-like. The phone rang, and I walked over to answer it.
"Is this Leo King?" a female voice asked.
"Yes, it is," I said.
"This is Jane Parker, Dr. Caldwell's assistant. We had a cancellation, and Dr. Caldwell can operate on Starla Whitehead at 8 in the morning this Friday at Medical U. Can she be there?"
"Starla Whitehead will be there," I said, then returned to the dancers and announced to the room,
"Starla, Dr. Caldwell's going to fix your eye."
The room cheered. Starla went to Niles, and brother and sister wept together in the quietest and most tender way. Their cargo of sadness always seemed unbearable, even on the night when both of them learned to dance.
Chapter 19. Pilgrims. Because I recount a past of utmost importance to those of us who survived it, I find myself trying for an exactness that might be unreachable. But color, smell, and music have always opened the rose windows, blind alleys, and trapdoors of the past in ways I find astonishing. My route as a paperboy has now retreated in memory as a related series of smells, barking dogs, early risers, joggers along the Battery, the discussion of the news with Eugene Haverford, my luxuriant daydreaming as I pedaled and slung and thought about the good life I was riding out to lead. My memories seem evergreen and verdant, so I am always comfortable walking through the front door of my past, confident in the shape and certitude of all that I carry from those days. On the day of Starla's operation, I delivered my newspapers with uncommon efficiency and speed. Afterward, I skipped going to Mass with my parents at the cathedral and having breakfast at Cleo's, and drove directly to the orphanage, where Starla and Niles awaited my arrival. Mr. Lafayette opened the gates with a key the size of a switchblade, then hugged Starla, wishing her the best of luck. It was the first time I realized that Starla had not taken off her sunglasses in public since Sheba had presented them as a gift. She and Niles both got in the front seat of the car, and I noted that Starla's hands were trembling as her brother tried to calm her fears. "Starla's terrified," Niles said, speaking for her, as he often did in times of distress. "So would anyone else be," I said. "It's natural." "She wants me to go into the operating room with her," Niles told me. "Dr. Caldwell said they have strict procedures for surgery. They won't let you." Starla managed in a small, shaky voice,
"I don't think I can do it without Niles. The idea of someone cutting through my eyeball is more than I can take. I don't want to go."
I tried to allay her fears.
"Dr. Caldwell says you're going to have beautiful eyes when the operation is over. Do you want to have to wear sunglasses the rest of your life?
Do you wear those things when you sleep?"
"Yes," she said, surprising me with quiet candor. "I only take them off in the shower. I want to hug Sheba every time I see her for giving them to me. You don't know what it's like to be a freak."
"You won't need them after today, I promise," I said.
"Starla, listen to me. Dr. Caldwell can fix all that."
"You didn't hear her, Buddy Roo," Niles said.
"She don't want to do it," she said. "We ain't going to the hospital."
"I heard you, Buddy Roo," I said as I slammed on the brakes.
"I'm taking Starla to the best eye surgeon in Charleston. He's operating for free. Now, I know what your sister's going through. My nickname's the Toad because my glasses are so thick they make my eyes look froggy. I know that. I own a mirror. If there was an operation for my eyes, I'd throw your sister out of the car and have Dr. Caldwell do me instead. So if you don't like it, Niles, get out of here. Leave us alone. In a couple of hours, this is going to be over with. Done.
Niles looked at his sister, who said,
He's right, Niles.
I'm only going along with this because you asked me to, Niles said to her. And of course he's right. He's the fucking toad.
Relieved, I told Niles, My heartless mother said you and I could wait outside the surgery room during the operation.
That's mighty nice of her, Starla said.
She'll never tell you this, but she's rooting hard for you two. She thinks God gave you a raw deal, I said. Here we are. You two get out and I'll park the car. Go on up to the surgical unit. They're waiting for you, Starla.
Has Dr. Caldwell ever done this kind of operation before? Starla asked, nervously. I wanted to ask him during the examination, but he was so nice to me that I chickened out.
Well, he's operated before, but never on anybody's eyeball. Until today, that is, I said.
His specialty is removing plantar warts.
You sorry son of a bitch, Niles snarled.
Joking around at a time like this? I'm going to whip your ass when we get to the waiting room.
Joking? Thank God he was joking, Starla said. I needed a joke. I need to laugh.
She took a breath and murmured,
I can do this.
Then do it, Mountain Girl, I said. I hear they don't make girls any tougher.
Never mess with me, Toad,
Starla said as she punched me on the shoulder and got out of the car.
Promise me if this operation doesn't work, you won't call me Cyclops, though.
Promise, I said.
An hour passed in the waiting room, and Niles began to pace like a caged panther, his muscles taut and his eyes burning. A door opened, and Fraser Rutledge made a surprise entrance, going directly over to Niles, giving him a sisterly hug. The hospital was a block south of Ashley Hall, the private school Fraser attended. She had gotten permission to skip her study hall to visit a sick friend. She whispered a few words to Niles, and though I could not hear them, I could see his shoulder muscles relax as she got him to sit down. She walked over to me, gave me a rough hug, and said,
You've been the talk at our dinner table for the past couple of nights, Leo.
Why on earth? I asked.
Chad admitted that he'd broken up with Molly. Man, it hit our house like an A-bomb. Molly's mother called my mother and said Chad had asked that slut Bettina Trask to the dance.
Bettina's not that bad, I said. She's up from crap, but she's smart as hell and tries hard. She's in my mother's advanced English course. Ask Niles.
Bettina's been nice to me and Starla, Niles said, even after we got into a fight with her boyfriend on the first day of school.
Well, I hear she puts out like a Pez dispenser, Fraser said. And Toad, I hear you're playing sloppy seconds for Chad.
Do your parents know you and I are dating yet, Fraser? Niles asked.
Not yet, she admitted nervously. And the time certainly isn't now.
The orphan and Bettina Trask, Niles said. Too much shame for your parents to bear in 1 week.
Don't go feeling sorry for yourself again, Niles Whitehead, Fraser said. I won't rich girl you to death if you don't beat me with the orphan stick, okay?
At that moment, Dr. Galden Caldwell entered the waiting room, wearing his scrubs and that maritime calmness that seemed to be his greatest asset as a physician. He was a handsome, aristocratic man who looked like he was bred to wear a stethoscope. His very presence calmed me, but more important, I saw a visible relaxation in Niles's ruffled demeanor. Gathering us around him, Dr. Caldwell spoke in a soft, authoritative voice.
I believe the operation was a success, but we won't know for sure for about 48 hours. Everything looked good. I'll be over each morning this weekend to check on the progress of her healing. We'll keep her groggy and sedated the whole time. I don't let my patients suffer pain. Before you go, you'll need to learn how to apply eye drops.
I can do that, Doctor, Niles said. I'm her brother.
So I hear, Dr. Caldwell said, turning to Niles. You owe a great debt of gratitude to Leo King here. He's the one who asked me to do this operation.
He's got it, Doctor, Niles answered.
For as long as we live.
You've got something too, Dr. Caldwell, I said.
What's that, Leo? The doctor asked.
Free newspapers for the rest of your life.
That's unnecessary, he said, but very gracious.
His young assistant, Jane Parker, as pretty as a cornflower, came out into the waiting room and asked,
Who needs to learn how to apply eye drops?
Teach all of them, Dr. Caldwell said. He began to leave, then stopped to say,
Mr. Whitehead, your sister is going to have something new come into her life, I expect.
What's that, doctor? Niles asked.
Gentlemen call us, he said.
Lots of gentlemen call us.
I don't get it, Niles said. Jane Parker laughed.
Your sister's a pretty girl, a darling girl. This is going to change her life.
In the locker room that night, an undercurrent of discord was loose as the players laced up their shoulder pads and strapped hip pads to their waists. Something invisible had sucked the spirit out of our team, and we seemed lethargic as the crowd filled the aisles of Stony Field, fired up by our undefeated season. The Hanahan team seemed like it was marching in step to some nihilistic death march that would bring our bright season to a demoralizing finish. The fiery love of competition that had carried us to a ninth-place ranking among the largest high schools of our state had either called in sick or decided to take a Friday night off. I could feel the first loss of the season adhering to our record before I had even finished dressing. Luckily, I was not the only one to notice it. Ike looked around.
What's wrong, Toad?
We seem dead, I said. We all need to be on an IV.
Hey, Renegades!
Ike yelled as he got up, fully dressed and ready to go. He went down the line pounding shoulder pads and slapping boys on the ass, trying to light a fire in a room without kindling or oxygen.
Let me see some fight in your eyes, he exhorted. You're acting like scarecrows, barnyard chickens. You guys forget who we are? We're the goddamn Renegades. We've beaten the Somerville Green Wave, the Beaufort Tidal Wave, the St. Andrews Rocks. And tonight we're playing a tough-as-shit Hanahan team that hasn't lost a game either. Where's the fight in you guys? Tell me where it went to hide, and I'll get up a search party to go find it.
A voice answered Ike, rebellious and unappeasable.
Sit down and shut up, boy. You're beating a dead horse.
The voice came from Wormy Ledbetter, who sat by his locker half-dressed. His challenge to the co-captain seemed cancerous to Team Unity, so I went to where Wormy sat and brought both my fists down hard on his shoulder pads. He jumped up with fists clenched, ready to fight me and Ike at the same time. Niles intervened by pulling me back by my jersey.
Call a team meeting before the coaches get here, he told Ike.
Ike ordered, Everybody dress on the double. 1 minute, then we meet in the conference room. This decree caused some grumbling among both the white and the black players, but at least it was an audible sign that the team was no longer brain dead. In less than 60 seconds, our entire team faced Ike and me as we stood in front of the blackboard, which was Coach Jefferson's personal realm of power.
Let's finish this thing, Ike said. Whatever it is, I don't know who this team is.
Guys, I said, what's wrong with the Renegades? We've gone through so much together.
The silence was complete, unbreakable. I was about to say something else inane in the vocabulary-stunted limitations of sport when Niles spoke up.
Wormy's pissed off because Chad's dating his girlfriend after the game tonight.
Ike whistled.
Chad, are you a plain fool or what? From what I hear, Bettina and Wormy have been going together forever.
Chad, nervous and uncertain, said,
I think Bettina just wanted to try a little white meat from the other side of the tracks.
From knowing Chad, I understood his response was part bravado and part an unstrategic use of his sense of humor. As I was trying to think of a funnier response, I watched the rhinoceros-like charge of Wormy leaping over three of his teammates to get to Chad, who was sitting next to a cinderblock wall. Amid the flailing fists and bursts of creative profanity, we managed to separate the two combatants. Chad was lucky for the success of our intervention.
I thought Wormy would have severed Chad's carotid artery with his crooked, yellowed teeth in the fury of that headlong charge. Eichendyke got unsteady handholds on Wormy's uniform, and he was guided back to his seat with far less relief than Chad felt. When Eichendyke gained control of the atmosphere, you could feel an agitation that had replaced the spiritual hollowness that had infected my teammates. As Ike began to speak, Coach Jefferson and his assistant entered from the coaching office. I ran down the cement aisle to intercept them and said, "We need 5 minutes, Coach. Gotta clear some things up. Team trouble, but we can handle it." Though Coach Jefferson was surprised, he was immediately responsive.
4 minutes.
He and his assistant retreated to his small, airless office. I ran back to the front of the blackboard.
"Wormy," Ike said, "we can't sacrifice this team for our love lives. We've all worked too hard. All of you know how I feel about Betty. But if my feelings for her ever got in the way of this team, I'd drop her, or at least during the season. All you guys got girlfriends. We're football players and girls like us. All of us except the Toad."
Even Wormy Ledbetter laughed along with the rest of my teammates. I roared, too, admiring the brilliance of Ike's strategy. Chad's voice rang in anger above the laughter.
"Hell, that's why I asked Bettina to the dance. The Toad asked Molly out. Bettina's been calling me for weeks."
Ike said with pure sarcasm, "Chad, you don't mean to tell me you got snaked by a fucking amphibian." Again, the team screamed with laughter, Wormy leading the way.
"Women can't keep their hands off me," I said. "It's been a problem since I was a kid. You guys call me the Toad, but women call me the Mink."
"Shit, bet you never kissed a girl," Chad sneered.
"That'll change tonight after he takes out Molly,"
Niles grinned, earning a big laugh from everyone but Chad, till Ike raised his hand to silence the room.
"That's enough. We got enough juice here to kick the living hell out of Hanahan. Wormy, use your anger about Bettina and Chad to have your best game of the year. The offensive line will make holes that you could drag a dead mule through. But we've got to find a way to stay angry and hostile against our opponents. This thing called team is a holy word to me. I'll beat the shit out of anyone who brings their poison to this locker room again. You hear me, Wormy? You hear me, Chad? Now let's take all this bad feeling, all of it, and make Hanahan High feel bad. Real bad."
A cheer went up as Coach Jefferson and his assistant entered from the rear, sensing a team incorrigible in its will to win. What Ike had let loose among us was the dream stuff of worthy coaches. Hanahan was the game that provided my team with the limitless momentum that would carry us to the state semifinal in Columbia. As we lined up that night, I could feel the first cool tinctures of autumn in the low country air. When we kicked off, I had a foot race with Ike down the field, and we both avoided two of their blockers. We both hit the ball carry at the same time and drove him out of bounds on his own 25 and into the midst of his team. Ike and I rose screaming before being overrun by our jubilant teammates. Whatever incubus or disease had invaded our locker room had received its banishment on that first play and would not return that season. A fierce tenacity remained our trademark. Wormy Ledbetter ran the ball more than 30 times, many times coming right up the middle, where I had my best night of blocking that year. The offensive line moved like a pride of lions as we fired off that line with aggression and certitude. I pancake-blocked four of their linemen, putting them flat on their backs as I watched Wormy crashing into defensive backs with his head lowered and his legs churning like an egg beater. When Niles faked to Wormy going off tackle, it opened the field for Chad and Ike, who both scored long touchdowns after Niles laid it in their hands as though he were tossing loaves of bread high into the night air. That night, Wormy set a school record by scoring 5 rushing touchdowns and gaining more than 200 yards on the ground. Niles completed 10 of 12 passes. Our defense played as though there were a forest fire in the end zone behind us. Hanahan didn't score until the final minutes of the game, when our second string gave up a harmless field goal. When the final whistle blew, we had defeated the fifth-ranked team in the state by an amazing score of 56-3. Our fans flooded the field after the game, but this time there was no pulling down the goalposts. A most miraculous thing had occurred. Our long-suffering football fans were becoming accustomed to winning. Drifting through that boisterous crowd was an entrance into Wonderland for me. I had longed for a normal life for so long that it seemed like an unobtainable ideal. But here is what it was at last. My taking leave of a football field, shaking hands with my Hanahan opponents, receiving the congratulations of fans and teammates, being hugged by girls whose names I didn't even know, by cheerleaders whose uniforms were as sweaty as mine. Yes, this was now my new normality, not being handcuffed to a bed at a mental hospital, paralyzed by drugs. I liked being part of a team with a game plan and a way of deliverance for a boy who knew how much he needed it. I drifted toward the locker room, believing I was savoring the ecstasy of the moment, until I realized I was postponing the inevitable. The real reason for my hesitation to join in the jubilation of my teammates was my fear of taking Molly Huggy to the sock hop after the game. When I entered the dimly lit gymnasium, the awful reminder hit me like a well-aimed meteorite that I had never been to a high school dance before and had no idea how to conduct myself. Nor was I sure how to set my face, a confident smile, an easy nonchalance, a cocky watchfulness. I found myself simply defenseless as I felt my face congeal into a dewy lostness. I saw Molly approach from across the gym. She had changed out of her cheerleading uniform and was dressed in a simple skirt and blouse and the white socks that the basketball coach required for even the most soft-footed dancer. She rushed forward to meet me and surprised me by hugging me and kissing me playfully on the cheek.
"What a great game, Leo. This team has a chance to go the distance."
"It already has for me," I told her. A song ended. The disc jockey for the evening and the rest of the year was the unflappable Trevor Poe. I heard him say,
"One of our all-stars, Leo King, has just entered the room. I'd like to call on him and his beautiful date, Molly Huggy, to lead off the next dance. I'd also like to call on his co-captain, Ike Jefferson, and his pretty date, Betty Roberts, to join them in the first slow dance of the evening. Slow dance! Doesn't it just make your toes curl to think about it? Now let's hear some well-deserved applause for our co-captains. Ah, that's it. Last year, Peninsula High was ranked last in the league, and here we stand undefeated beneath the eyes of man and God. I call this the co-captain dance. The floor is theirs until I give the signal with my tambourine. Now, let the DJ work his showmanship."
Trevor set the needle down, and Bert Kampfert's Wonderland by Night flooded the gym with notes so sensuous and romantic that each one seemed honey-flecked. Taking Molly into my arms was one of the defining moments of my life. Her cheek touched mine, and her hand pulled me close. Her breath was minty and fresh when she whispered,
"I love this song."
I wished I could force her to spend all eternity whispering in my ear. As we danced, the hushed crowd watched us in breathless silence. I caught Ike's eye and he winked at me. Feeling one-tenth sexy for the first time, I winked back with the palmy confidence of a world-famous womanizer or a left-bank boulevardier on the prowl in Paris, instead of a loser on his first date. Molly smelled like the climbing jasmine that overwhelmed the trellises in my mother's summer garden. I could breathe in sunshine and balsam in her hair, and her breasts felt soft and yielding, yet untouchable. Trevor tapped his tambourine, and the rest of the school joined us. Wonderland by Night would be my favorite song for the rest of my life because of Molly Huggy's bright eyes, shapely lips, pretty face, lovely body. Because I felt my soul leave my own fortressed country of hurt and surrender and the time it took for a 90-second song to begin and end. I was dizzy with my love of Molly when I spotted Niles and Fraser motioning to us from the front door. Taking Molly's hand, I led her through the frenzied dancers who were dancing to the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Though it shouldn't have surprised me, Fraser and Molly threw their arms around each other and began silently weeping. They excused themselves and rushed to the ladies' room on the other side of the gym, leaving me and Niles alone. "We just visited Starla in the hospital," Niles said. "She's still groggy as hell, but we told her all about the game. She laughed when she heard that Chad was dating Bettina and that Molly sought revenge by asking you to the dance." "Why'd she laugh?" "Starla's always had a thing about mischief," Niles said. "She loves to see things stirred up, everything simmering right to the boiling point." "Why aren't Chad and Bettina at the dance?" I asked. "Fraser's positive that Chad has taken her to the beach house on Sullivan's Island, trying to get laid." "I handled the crisis well tonight," I said. "The cat's a leader," Niles said. "It comes natural to him." "Why did Fraser and Molly start crying when they saw each other?" "They've been best friends for a long time," Niles said. "Fraser started crying as soon as she saw you dancing with Molly. She can't remember a time when Chad and Molly weren't sweethearts." "I think Molly really likes me," I said. "I really do." Niles studied me for a moment, and I could study him in return as he tried to form the correct words in his mind, truthful words, but not ones that would injure an already wounded spirit. "Toad," he said, "we're not in these girls' league. We're playthings to them. We're not the boys they're going to turn to when they get serious about life. Chad's convinced Fraser that she's the homeliest girl in the world. She needs me now because I think she's the nicest girl I've ever met, and she's a doll, too. I've always had to pick out girls who thought they were ugly as homemade sin, and they're always grateful for my attention. Then Starla gets a wild hair up her ass and tells me we're running away from another orphanage." "Why do you always go with her?" I asked. "She couldn't survive without me." "Why don't you talk her out of it? You checked out my sister's listening skills?" "No, I guess I haven't." "That's because she ain't got any," Niles said. "Why do you put up with it?" "She's all I've got," Niles answered. "Maybe all I'll ever have." "Nah," I said. "You're the star quarterback. Star quarterbacks get anything they want." "This year's going too good," he said. "It's scaring the shit out of me."
"Then enjoy it."
"Can't. Here's the one given of my and my sister's life. We're not allowed to have a good time." Niles brightened. "Look there, Toad. Two pretty girls looking for us. It doesn't get much better than that, does it?" "It's at the top of my list." Molly took my hand and led me back out onto the dance floor, where we danced every dance, slow or fast or in between, for the rest of that magical evening. Dancing with Molly Huggy became the standard by which I measured all the rare incursions of magic into my life. She was a high-spirited dancer with a natural gracefulness that came wrapped in sexy undertones. That night, as I listened to Trevor announce every song with a brief, witty, and sometimes bawdy introduction, I learned that I loved to dance and could feel myself grow better at it as the night wore on. Looseness was the bright essence of the dance, the prominent ingredient necessary to let the bloodstream join the rhythm of the music and the girl whose hand you held. Two bloodstreams, two bodies conjoined until looseness took command and swirled you into a zone of comfort where you'd never been before. There was a commotion at the front door. Sheba Poe made one of the cinematic entrances that would become her trademark, and her brother announced the noteworthiness of the moment. In his beret and sunglasses, Trevor beat time on the palm of his hand with his tambourine as Sheba danced into the middle of the floor. Of course, she could not just date the president of the National Honor Society or the captain of the basketball team. No. Sheba Poe had brought the regimental commander of the Citadel as her inaugural date of the year.
At center court, ladies and gentlemen, is the undiscovered starlet of stage and silver screen, that sultry siren of the forbidden night, that unforgettable vixen known to all of you as the delectable Sheba Poe. Her date is the redoubtable regimental commander of the Citadel, Cadet Colonel Franklin Lymington from 96 South Carolina. You know 96? It's right next to 97 and just down the road from 100 South Carolina.
The audience booed Trevor with good-natured relish and marveled that he had been a South Carolina resident for such a short period, yet had already milked the comedy from one of the state's most oddly named towns. Trevor then put on Bill Haley and the Comets' Rock Around the Clock. He pulled Sheba up on the stage with him, and the twins performed the sexiest, most orgasmic dance I had ever seen. It drove the black kids at the dance wild, and the twins' gyrations freed them from the inhibitions they had carried to a formerly all-white high school. The poor regimental commander from 96 stood watching his date perform a sinuous, leopard-like dance that looked part Zulu and part nervous breakdown. As Trevor put on the next record, he said,
"There are people who are not dancing in this gym. Bashfulness is banned. Get bold. Everyone here is going to dance to the next song, so get ready. Sheba and I will show you how it's supposed to be done. Then you follow our lead."
The stroll blasted through the speakers, and Trevor leaped in a graceful, feather-like jump from the stage. I remembered my brother Steve trying to teach me that dance when we were both small boys, and how we would strut and show off in front of my parents as they applauded every exaggerated move. Molly took my hand, and we began our own version of the stroll down the center of the gymnasium. We added jerks and shakes and spontaneous throws that were brand new to both of our bodies, and people began to clap in appreciation of our unpracticed duet. In front of us, I watched as Sheba and Trevor separated and went trolling along the front line of the crowd to pull out the shyest, most unnoticed students and make them join the dance. Being a failed teenager is not a crime, but a predicament and a secret crucible. It is a funhouse mirror where distortion and mystification lead to the bitter reflections that sometimes ripen into self-knowledge. Time is the only ally of the humiliated teenager, who eventually discovers that the golden boy of the senior class is the bald, bloated drunk at the 20th reunion, and that the homecoming queen married a wife-beater and philanderer and died in a drug rehabilitation center before she was 30. The prince of acne rallies in college and is now head of neurology, and the homeliest girl blossoms in her 20s, marries the chief financial officer of a national bank, and attends her reunion as the president of the junior league. But since a teenager is denied a crystal ball that will predict the future, there is a forced march quality to this unspeakable rite of passage. When a girl feels the first drops of menstrual blood, how is she to know that this is the sacred stream of life, the stir of her blooming fertility, the world's thunderous answer to decay and death? And what is a boy to think when he studies the great surprise of semen in his hand, except that his body has become a firestorm and undiscovered volcano, where lava is made in the furnace of his loins? It is an unforgivable crime for teenagers not to be able to absolve themselves for being ridiculous creatures at the most hazardous time of their lives. As the dance broke up, Molly stood on her tiptoes and whispered to me,
"I'm starved. Let's go get a barbecue sandwich at the Piggy Park."
"Sounds good to me," I said.
"Don't you think the Piggy Park has the best barbecue in town?" she asked.
"Never tasted better," I lied. Since I'd never been out on a date before, I had never ventured near that legendary national park of Charleston teenage bliss. It could also be a dangerous hormonal gathering place that competing high schools wanted to claim as home territory. The undisputed kingpin of the Piggy Park was Wormy Ledbetter, with his greasy sycophants with their big muscles and borderline IQs. but I would have taken Molly Huggy to the Berlin Wall if she had asked me in her sweet voice. Niles and Fraser approached us at the same moment that Trevor came skipping up to us, working his tambourine like a gambler rolling dice. Before we could silence the noise, Ike and Betty entered our circle. Ike asked, "You going over to the piggy park, Toad?" "Molly just gave me the marching orders."
"I've never seen any black people over there," Molly said with a worried look.
Ike laughed. "I'd rather go to a Klan rally, but Wormy invited me and all the black guys on the team. Said it'd be okay."
"Trevor, why don't you ride with Ike and Betty?" Fraser suggested. "Is Sheba off with her regimental commander? By the way, that's quite a catch."
"She'll dump him tomorrow," Trevor said. "She already thinks he's a hick, and he dances like some alien life form."
"Why don't you follow me in my car?" I said to Ike. "We can park together and watch out for each other."
"Good plan,"
Ike said. But I could sense his uneasiness, a little sick of desegregating one Woolworth's lunch counter after another as they appeared in infinite succession.
"But if anything happens to Betty..."
Betty scoffed.
"You worry about yourself, Ike Jefferson. Put a Coke bottle in my hands and I can handle the three best white boys at the piggy park."
"You talk big, girl,"
Ike said, smiling for the first time.
"I talk truth, son."
"I find sexual tension so provocative,"
Trevor said, rattling his tambourine as we all laughed and headed for the parking lot. At the piggy park on Rutledge Avenue, a stone's throw from Hampton Park, I drove to the far corner of the drive-in, leaving room for Ike to pull up beside me. Molly proved that she was a regular at the place by immediately ordering a Coke with a barbecue sandwich platter. Suddenly, it hit me in a flash of blazing insight that Niles lived in an orphanage and did not have a nickel to his name.
"Let's get four of those," I said. "My treat, Niles and Fraser."
"You're a good man, Toad," Niles said, and I could hear the relief in his voice. Wormy Ledbetter strode out to greet us, accompanied by some of his lowbrow entourage. I stiffened at his approach. There was always a trace of the lynch mob in Wormy's eyes, but he entered our realm as a teammate tonight. As Niles and I got out of the car, he embraced us fiercely and said that our defeat of Hanahan made for the best day of his life. Then he looked over at Ike and said,
"Get out of the fucking car, Jefferson."
Ike did, and Wormy rushed over to hug him in full view of White Charleston. In that single gesture, something broke forever in the mystery that was the South.
"God damn, you were great tonight, Ike," said Wormy. "So were Niles and the Toad. God damn, all great."
"But my father gave you the game ball," Ike said. "He hasn't done that all year."
"The biggest honor of my life," Wormy said,
as emotional and vulnerable as I had ever seen that flesh-eating redneck.
"Tell your daddy I said so, you hear?"
"I'll tell him," Ike said. Wormy walked back to the realm of his wormydom, and our trays came out. The car hop fixed them expertly on our windows, and the smell of hickory-smoked hog filled the car like an anthem to hunger itself. I wolfed down my sandwich in record-setting time, and so did Niles in the back seat. We had just played a 48-minute football game and danced the night away, and our primitive, almost desperate hunger caught us both by surprise. Niles said,
"I could eat that whole hog, including his eyeballs and asshole."
Fraser looked shocked, then answered,
"That's the crudest thing I've ever heard anyone say. Don't you think, Molly?"
"It ranks high,"
Molly said, but she was giggling. Just as suddenly, she wasn't giggling, and her expression turned fearful and cold. Following her eyes, I turned and saw Chad Rutledge's old model Chrysler LeBaron pulling into the piggy park, doing a slow circumnavigation of the drive-in and doing it twice, so he would be sure to be noticed by all present. Twice, he passed directly in front of us and tooted his horn, trying to get Molly's attention. But he failed to get her to look up from her sandwich. Beside him, Bettina Trask rode in triumph, the smile of a low-rent, cut-rate Cleopatra lighting up her face.
"That bastard," I heard Fraser saying back.
Niles groaned. Jesus, he's mocking Wormy to his face.
Chad had chosen the parking spot nearest to the picnic benches, where Wormy and his troop of no-goodnicks hung out with their cigarette-smoking girlfriends and beer-drinking buddies. Though I felt like a voyeur to some kind of disaster, my eyes were riveted to the scene of the skirmish that was about to take place. I did not hear Ike get out of his car or make his way to my window.
"Let this one go, teammates," Ike said. "This is like taunting a king cobra. Whatever happens, Chad is asking for it."
"Why is he doing it?" I asked.
"Because he knows his place in this city," Molly answered. "He's untouchable, and he wants to prove it to Wormy. And to you, Leo and Ike. And to you, Niles."
"I'm curious, Molly Fraser. What does Chad think of us, really?" Niles asked.
"Actually, he likes all of you very much," Molly said. "He's grateful how you've accepted him on the team."
"Deep down," Niles pressed. "How does he feel deep down?" Fraser closed her eyes, then said calmly,
"He thinks you are all beneath him. Way beneath him."
"It's fun to know you're appreciated," Ike said. He kept his eyes sealed on the action near the front of the drive-in.
When it happened with quickness and contained the devastating power of surprise. Wormy leaped off the picnic table and rushed to Chad's car, opened the front door, and pulled Chad out by his hair. Chad's scream found itself muffled by the jeering laughter and the applause of Wormy's friends, who'd been alerted to the imminence of the attack. Backhanding Chad twice on the face, Wormy challenged him to a fair fight and put up his fists in a boxer's experienced stance. If Chad had just fought Wormy, man to man, I think the outcome of the evening might have had a more honorable end. But instead of raising his fists, Chad answered in a loud voice, audible, I think, over most of the peninsula.
"Wormy, my father taught me never to lower myself by fighting white trash."
"Oh, he did he?" Wormy said. "My, my. Well, I have a different theory. I think you're chicken shit from the bottom of your feet to the top of your head. A South Abroad pussy too scared to defend himself."
Wormy stepped forward and, with his open palm, began to slap Chad's face hard. Slap, 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 until Chad screamed,
"I'd kick the shit out of you, Wormy, but my parents taught me to always take the high road and never let a common redneck drag me down to his level. Defend yourself, pussy. This ain't no fun. This ain't no fight."
"How do you fight a man without no pride?" Wormy said to the crowd, then surprised everyone by ripping off Chad's expensive and well-tailored shirt, leaving Chad looking as naked as a slug in a summer garden. It is difficult for a shirtless man to be taken seriously in a parking lot where every other man is wearing a shirt. Until that moment, I had never considered that possibility. Viewing his domain and his options, Wormy looked around the piggy park, then down at the shirt he had torn from Chad's body. In a moment of rare creativity for him, Wormy blew his nose into Chad's swell shirt, then threw it on the ground and kicked dirt and debris all over it. Without a pause, Wormy walked around Chad's car, opened the passenger door, and offered his hand to Bettina Trask. To my surprise, Bettina took Wormy's hand and let herself be led by the arm in a garish triumphal march into the parlor beside the barbecue pit. In a humiliation as complete as I had ever witnessed, Chad watched this event unfold, trembling with helplessness and rage. He shook his fist heavenward and shouted toward the open door.
"Hey, Wormy, you fucking shitbird redneck! I'm going home to lift weights for a year. Then I'm coming back to whip your goddamn ass. 1 year from tonight. That's a promise. And I'm a man of my word. I'm a descendant from one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. So you know I'm a man of honor. 1 year, and I come back to kick your ass up and down and all over the piggy park."
Wormy walked out for a final time, shaking his head sadly. Then he backhanded poor Chad to his knees.
"Shut up, Chad," Wormy said. "I'm eating a sandwich with my girlfriend now."
The laughter was unbearable.
In my car, we watched as Chad got into his car, backed it up, then headed our way instead of exiting on Rutledge Avenue. When he got in front of my car, he shook his fist at me, then sat on his horn, maniacal and unhinged. I heard something to my right and turned to see Molly getting out of my car, shutting the door, and walking calmly to Chad's car. He flung the door open, motioned for her to enter, and Molly sat down in the place she was born to sit. Though I struggled with a restless exhaustion for most of that night, I slept hard in the last hour before the alarm sounded at 4:30, when I awoke to the starlit world of paperboys. I rode my Schwinn slowly down to Colonial Lake, every muscle in my body burning with fatigue and every cell of my body nearing collapse from the humiliation of Molly's public desertion of me. As I pedaled slowly, the thought occurred to me that I had just suffered through the most unsuccessful first date in the history of the sexes. Caught up in a maelstrom of an obsession I could not shake, I tried to recall every salient detail of how I had behaved with Molly from the moment she kissed me on the cheek to her measured, purposeful departure from the front seat of my car to the more familiar one of Chad's. What had hurt me most keenly was the unnatural coldness of Molly's leave-taking. It was breathless in its wordlessness, the lack of farewell or a blown goodbye kiss or any attempt of an explanation. I wished that she had aborted our evening with a little more finesse and allowed me to take her home, endure my unbearable awkwardness at her front door, then called Chad for their tender reunion. That she left me publicly, with my whole team as eyewitnesses to my mortification, was nightmare enough, but to do it with Niles and Chad's sister in my back seat lent a touch of malice or inattention I didn't think I deserved. In the back seat, Niles and Fraser had sat paralyzed, bee-stung into silence. Finally, I had said, "You know, I thought we were double-dating. Now it seems like I'm your chauffeur." But there was a knock on the window, and Trevor jumped in to occupy the space just vacated by Molly. I saw the whole thing. It was pure Elizabethan drama with a little barbecue sauce thrown in. We live in a town that is provincially bigoted against the culturally astute, effeminate young men such as myself. Allow me a minute to explain. Since I have arrived in the city limits of Charleston, I have been variously described as a faggot, a queer, a cocksucker, a fudge packer, a fairy queen, a sodomite, a pervert, and a wide assortment of other unpardonable slurs. Of course, in my case, such slurs are perfectly applicable. I can make all your mean thoughts about Molly go bye-bye, Leo. Niles said from the back seat in a tone of innocent wonder, "How have you gotten this old, Trevor, without somebody killing you?" "I have my tricks of the trade," Trevor said it so good-naturedly that I started to laugh. I said, "Trevor, I don't even know what gay people do to each other." "And I don't want to know," Niles said. "Ditto," Fraser said, putting her hands over her ears. "It involves meat hooks and razor blades and flamethrowers and dildos made from buffalo penises." "What's a dildo?" Niles asked. "Poor mountain idiot," Trevor sighed. "I don't know either," I said. "Look, Leo, after what just happened to you, I'm going to give you a free introductory lesson, and I'll waive the usual initiation fees as a personal favor." "Thanks, Trevor," I said. "Just by getting in the car, you saved me from an embarrassing situation. I'll never forget it." "You baked me cookies," Trevor said. "First day in Charleston, and I'm eating Benny wafers baked by the loneliest kid in the world." "Molly shouldn't have treated you that way. She should be ashamed." "Leo doesn't expect a girl like Molly to go with a boy like him," Fraser said.
"Why the hell not?" Niles asked.
"Oh, don't get defensive on me, Niles," she flashed back. "The differences are too great, and as a Charleston boy, Leo knows that. Charleston society keeps in the shadows, but it's still the most important force in this town."
"Got your word on that?" Niles said.
"You're walking into a trap, honey," Trevor warned Fraser.
"You can always trust the word of someone related to a signer of the Declaration of Independence," Niles mocked with a reptilian cold-bloodedness. I learned that from a great man tonight. A guy who could run his mouth, but couldn't use his fists.
Chad was trained to be a gentleman, Fraser said defensively.
Cut, my dear, cut. This scene is getting out of hand, Trevor advised Fraser.
I come from people who never heard of the Declaration of Independence, who couldn't read a word of it if they had to, Niles said.
My folks wouldn't read a book if you put a gun to their dicks, but they can read people all day long and always get it right.
You're going to say something you don't mean, Niles, Trevor said. Let's change the subject to the price of mangoes in Argentina or the life expectancy of a no-see-um.
You were bragging about your people's ability to read other people, Fraser reminded Niles.
Your brother Chad is not half the man that Toad is, or Trevor, or Ike, said Niles. And this will be the shock of the night for you, Fraser.
Or me.
He's had every opportunity in the world, and he still ain't worth a shit.
Could you drive Fraser home, Toad? I'm going over to the next car to be with the niggers where I belong.
Niles left my car even as a distraught Fraser tried to grab his arm. Then I heard him ask Ike,
Can I catch a ride back to the orphanage with you and Betty?
That's not what I meant to say,
Fraser murmured tearfully as she watched Niles climb into Ike's back seat.
It came out all wrong.
Why don't you tell that to Niles? Trevor said.
Honey? The tongue is the most powerful and destructive organ in the human body.
But Ike had already cranked his car and was heading toward Rutledge Avenue.
I followed and drove Fraser home.
Trevor escorted her to the door with his matchless sense of the dramatic, then performed an elegant soft shoe back to the car. I parked my bicycle by the news and courier truck, lifted the first bale of newspapers and cut through the steel binders with my wire cutters. I began to fold the papers quickly, securing them with a new and stronger rubber band. Mr. Haverford's immense hulk made a shadow behind me, and I wished him good morning without looking up.
"You ever go out with women, Mr. Haverford?" I asked.
"Broke that bad habit years ago."
"Why?"
"Played the law of averages." Went out with a lot of women when I was young. 100% of them were assholes or heartbreakers. I could take the assholes, but the heartbreakers could inflict some real damage.
I can't imagine you heartbroken.
I was married once, he said. Ever tell you that?
No, sir, I said, surprised. Who'd you marry?
Mrs. Haverford, you little bastard, he said, smirking. We even had a kid, a boy. The kid would be in his late 20s by now. My wife fell in love with a welder in the Navy. They moved to San Diego. Never heard from her or the boy again.
You never heard from your son?
I don't even know if he's alive, Mr. Haverford said. He's ignored my every attempt to stay in touch with him. What kind of sorry kid wouldn't want to get to know his own daddy?
An asshole, Mr. Haverford, I said. Anyone who wouldn't be proud to have you as an old man isn't worth a shit.
I thought you'd killed that Hanahan halfback last night, he said. That was your best tackle of the year.
You were at the game?
Got a season ticket.
We got Wando High next week, I said.
You'll cut their asses, he said. I like this colored coach of yours. You guys have only jumped off sides twice this season. That's good coaching. And his kid, Ike, he's a Bearcat.
A great guy, too, I said.
Be careful of humanity, he said. It's a bad breed overall.
Eugene Haverford, the philosopher, I said.
Eugene Haverford, the realist. Anytime you want to talk to me about the girl, I'll be happy to.
Girl? What girl?
The heartbreaker, he said softly. It happened last night, didn't it, kid? Take your time. I'm here every morning, half drunk but always ready to talk with an ass full of life behind me and a nickel's worth left to live. Now, go deliver the news of the world to Charleston.